through grassroots change at ajws.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Restaurant Week Portsmouth and the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 42 restaurants, November 3rd to the 12th. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. And Waste Management, producing enough energy to power more than 1 million homes every year. By 2020, they expect to double that output. Learn more at thinkgreen.com. The forecast today, mostly sunny statewide and mild, highs in the lower to mid-60s. It'll become cloudy tonight. Some patchy fog will form. Could be some drizzle overnight in southern regions, with overnight lows in the 40s across the state. Thursday, it'll be cloudy. We'll see showers developing from south to north, heaviest in the afternoon. Temperatures between 55 and 60 tomorrow. In Conway, it is 38 degrees. In Concord, it's 43. In Nashua, 46. In Portsmouth, 53. And in Keene, it's 41 degrees. I'm Rick Antley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Yes, this is New England, and yes, we get bad weather, and yes, the power goes out. But New Hampshire's two U.S. senators recently said enough is enough. After a Halloween weekend storm left more than 300,000 Granite State customers without power, Senators Jean Shaheen and Kelly Ayotte called for greater federal oversight of the nation's electric grid. In a letter to regulators, they noted three major outages in just the past 2 years, the windstorm of early 2010, Hurricane Irene this past August, and the Halloween storm, all affecting hundreds of thousands of residents, leaving some powerless for weeks. Then just yesterday, Governor Lynch chimed in on this, asking the Public Utilities Commission to review electric company preparedness and response. Utility executives say these storms have been historic, also that power restoration is incredibly complicated and labor-intensive. That said, the state has learned much from each storm and has applied these lessons to the next weather emergency. Still, most admit our system is far from perfect. We've got a ways to go in terms of our grid, providing emergency supplies and services, intrastate communications, and even us here in the media in terms of how we can best inform you, the public. Today in The Exchange, dealing with disaster and getting ready for the next one, let's hear from you. How do you see our emergency preparedness getting better or worse over the years? What do you think the biggest gaps are in our system of readiness and response to major weather events? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us on the phone from Boston is Russ Webster. He's Federal Preparedness Coordinator for FEMA's regional office in Boston. And Russ, nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me.
And with me in studio, Chris Pope, Director of New Hampshire Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Chris Pope is also Concord's former fire chief. And Chris, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, and both of you, Chris, you first, before we get into all the preparedness and response issues, does it seem to you that we have a lot more events to respond to in the last, I don't know, decade or so? What do you think, Chris?
The answer is an absolute yes. We've had 10, in the 5-plus years that I've served in this position, we've had 10 federally declared disasters in New Hampshire. And that's a huge number for a very small state. You know, we're only 200 miles long and probably 100 miles wide at our widest point. And so it's significant. And it's also not just been the same type of event. I mean, we've been dealing with tornadoes and nor'easters and ice storms and, a lot of different types of events that have really challenged the state.
Floods, too. Don't forget those.
Well,
right?
And that's probably our most significant threat from a natural disaster perspective in the state. And it's not just in one part of the state. Our North Country's experienced it, the southern part of the state. So it's been spread out.
Well, Russ, what do you think? There you are at FEMA looking at this. Are there more weather emergencies or are we just paying more attention?
No, I think absolutely this year especially there have been $10 billion disasters in New England with Tropical Storm Irene experienced its first regional billion-dollar disaster. And by the time we're done recovering in the six New England states, Irene is going to cost well over $1 billion in terms of fixing the infrastructure and support. In fact, 90% of the Robert T. Stafford Act presidential declarations for disasters each year are keyed to weather events, and connected with that, more than 500 people each year perish due to weather events.
Wow. Well, and picking up on something Chris Pope said, Russ, so what are we learning from each of these events? Again, you know, a flood, an ice storm, a tornado, the windstorm in February 2010 that knocked out power, and then this freaky trick-or-treat Halloween storm. What are we learning from each of these events? What do you think, Russ?
Well, it all begins with the individual, and I think that's a consistent message in changing the mindset of people from being victims to being survivors is key to a cultural change that I think the media will pay an increasing role along the way. It begins with the individual understanding where they are, whether they're at home or at work, and understanding the unique threats and hazards to them there and how they can best support themselves and their family unit through preparedness.
What do you think, Chris? Wow.
Well, he's absolutely right, and it's an issue of resilience. And, you know, it doesn't mean that on the one hand, citizens have to walk around gun-shy all the time and go, oh, my God, a storm's coming. Where am I going to be in 3 days? I think just what it means is that individuals, families, and businesses, by the way, have a general sense of awareness on a day-to-day basis of what's going on around them. What, you know, is there bad weather coming? Having a basic level of preparedness. You don't need to spend hours and hours and hours getting prepared. There's some really basic things you can do, spend a short amount of time doing to get your family better prepared or your business better prepared to manage. And that increases our resiliency and it turns us into survivors rather than victims, as Russ stated.
So, okay, looking systemically though, Chris, then, as a state, what are we learning in terms of, you know, practices, procedures, ways of thinking about what we're going to do when these things approach us?
Well, we do after-action report. We try to do after-action reports, formal ones, after every major incident. I will tell you, we have not even started a formal after-action process from Irene.
Sort of
and now
at,
we've got two lined
looking at
up.
What we learned and what we
absolutely.
Should do next time.
What did we do right? What did we do wrong? What can we do better? And develop a formal improvement plan for how we're going to fix those. So we've done that, for example, with the 2008 ice storm. Made a lot of changes in terms of our approach and how we do things. So and that's critical to building that better teamwork approach.
Well, what kind of changes? I'm curious. And Russ, I'll get you in on this too. But Chris, what kind of changes?
Well, things like how we work together to during the ice storm. How do we work with the National Weather Service to develop our level of awareness? As a storm approaches, for example. So during Irene, we watched that storm for days, and we had a very significant level of preparedness prior to the arrival of that storm. Storm still impacted us significantly, but I would suggest that we significantly reduced morbidity and mortality in the state because of the actions that primarily, by the way, local public safety officials took, working jointly together with us at the state and at the federal level.
Well, and we'll be talking a little bit later in the hour to one local emergency preparedness official in the town of Derry. But what do you think, Russ? How are we approaching emergency preparedness, emergency response differently now than maybe a decade or a decade and a half ago when we started seeing all these weather events?
Well, I think the big difference is out of these tragedies in the past, both in the school system and also natural and man-made disasters, has come an extraordinary response from the government at all levels. And with the 10 years of investment in many billions of dollars have come in some extraordinary programs, all of them free and available to individuals, to communities, to schools. A few years ago, the National Weather Service, NOAA, distributed 183,000 weather warning radios to every school system in the United States. And hand in glove with that, they created a program called the Storm Ready Program. And Storm Ready is a program for communities, colleges, and commercial facilities to get certified and accredited that they're prepared as much as that particular community, college, or business can be based on a national standard. Right now, Manchester and Nashua are pursuing Storm Ready status, and it's a great program and a great way for communities, colleges, and commercial facilities to look at themselves relative to a national standard and access the many resources that both the National Weather Service and NOAA offer. Similarly, the Red Cross has a brand new program for small businesses and schools called Ready Rating and Ready When the Time Comes. And let's see, the Saco Valley Gymnastics Training Center in Conway and the Shortridge Academy in Milton, New Hampshire are the early front runners for those programs in New Hampshire.
So it's almost like a federal certification that you go through to say, okay, I'm ready.
Yeah, in terms of the Storm Ready program, yes. The Red Cross program is a very informal, easy-to-access online self-assessment process that will create a dialogue in a small business that really doesn't have time to get into complicated, formal, standards-based accreditation. I did the Ready Rating program with my staff here, and we just use it as a dialogue, a way to improve on a continuous basis.
You know, this is interesting, Russ, because people think of FEMA rushing in after a disaster, but it sounds like your agency is taking on a role preparing, educating before an emergency. Is that a new role, or is that just something that people aren't that aware about?
Well, I think it changed after Katrina, and there was a bit of legislation, the Post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act, that recognized that preparedness activities need to be ongoing, irregardless of whether a particular area or region is involved in an immediate disaster response or recovery. So probably my best example of that was a few weeks ago, I was in New Hampshire at the Joint Field Office that was set up for the ongoing recovery efforts. A few days later, I was in Rhode Island working on preparedness activities with about 60 school administrators. So the lesson we learned in Katrina was you have to keep the energy and the eye on the ball and preparedness in all phases of whatever is going on. In fact, now, remarkably, in New Hampshire and other places that have recently been affected by disaster is an ideal time for people to pay attention and say, okay, we weren't quite ready in this particular area. I'm going to ask for some help. And between Director Pope and my staff, I'm sure we'd be glad to help.
So that's interesting. It's a rule that changed after Katrina, realizing that you got to educate people and keep people up to speed on disaster preparedness, even when times seem fine.
And we haven't even, Laura, mentioned mitigation, which is because everything Russ Webster said, I agree with 110%. We work with FEMA, but mitigation is critical too. So are there things that we can do that we know another storm's coming? So what can we do? What investments can we make that will be cost effective? So instead of spending billions out in recovery from these disasters, are there things that we can do to get people out of harm's way, get structures out of floodplains and things like that? And we're doing a lot of that here in New Hampshire as well.
So if there was a culvert that continually keeps, you know, bursting open, let's widen it.
Or a house
or
that's in a floodway or a floodplain.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. And coming up, we'll focus more in specifically on problems with the electricity grid.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network organizations partnering with New Hampshire colleges and universities in November to bring you I'm Going to College Month, nhcollegeclub.org. From Holly Oil, a full-service oil company, keeping New Hampshire families warm since 1961, delivering bioheat to customers throughout Manchester and Concord, Holly Oil, HALLEOIL.com. And Tupelo Music Hall, presenting singer-songwriter and social activist Chadwick Stokes, December 2nd in Londonderry and December 3rd in White River Junction. Tickets at TupeloHall.com. More on how prepared is New Hampshire for the natural disasters on The Exchange on NHPR and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show analysis of the 2011 election. New Hampshire weather today, another nice one, partly to mostly sunny with high temperatures mid-60s across most of the state, 55 to 60 degrees in the North Country. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how prepared is the Granite State for the next big storm? Speaking of emergency preparedness, I'd like to let you know that today at 2 o'clock this afternoon, the emergency alert system will undergo its first national-wide test. This national test of the EAS will last approximately 3 minutes. will be heard on all radio and TV stations across the country. If you want more information about this special EAS test, that's available on our website, nhpr.org. So again, 2 o'clock this afternoon. Don't worry, it is just a test. This hour, we're looking at how well New Hampshire has responded to the many weather disasters and emergencies we've seen over the past decade. And we want your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Chris Pope is with us, Director of New Hampshire's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Also, Russ Webster, Federal Preparedness Coordinator for FEMA's regional office in Boston. And joining us now on the phone is Gary Long. He's President and Chief Operating Officer of Public Service of New Hampshire, the state's largest utility. And Gary, thanks a lot for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, Senators Shaheen and Ayotte have called for a federal review of how reliable our electric grid is in light of the frequent and severe outages we've seen recently. Governor Lynch has jumped in. He wants the PUC to look at readiness. What do you think, Gary? Is this worth examining?
I think it is. I think it's very helpful if the more people understand what the emergency response plan is and how we go about repairing electrical systems. So we welcome those reviews. What's happened in the last 3 years, we've had 4 historic events, and they have been so large, and the public is getting used to them or are experiencing them more. And so it really takes a greater focus, certainly a greater regional focus. When a whole region gets hit with an event, that's very different than if just New Hampshire or some specific geographic area gets hit by an event, which is much easier to deal with. But when you have these large regional events, it does take more understanding and more people working together.
Well, we hear a lot about aging infrastructure, and sometimes people throw the electric grid into that. What do you think? How good is our electric infrastructure?
We actually have the strongest electric structure that we've had in all of time. We've put a tremendous amount of investment in it, both the transmission and distribution systems, over the last 10 years. It's not really so much a problem with the structure because our equipment isn't failing. It's trees. I mean, it's all about trees and limbs hitting power lines and knocking them down and breaking them. So it's not a function of the system itself. It's really a function of the severity of the weather event that's been occurring. And these weather events have been extreme. They've had the 4 highest damaged events in all of time happen in the last 3 years.
Wow. Well, in Connecticut, Gary, the Hartford Current is saying that part of the problem there was maintenance of power lines, that Northeast Utilities has cut back on routine maintenance and that has been part of the problem. Has PSNH also cut back on maintenance in recent years? You're also owned by Northeast Utilities.
Exactly. Northeast Utilities is our parent company, and Connecticut Light and Power is a sister company. And I can tell you, we have not, absolutely have not cut back on maintenance or investment. And in fact, we've enhanced our maintenance programs over the last couple of years. So, it's not the maintenance of equipment that's caused the equipment to fail. What's caused equipment to fail is trees.
Well,
falling on these lines.
And here's an email regarding that from Patricia that I got this morning, Gary, and I'd love to read it to you. She says, it is time now to allow communities to require that power, indeed all utility lines for new construction, be buried. The utilities say it is too expensive. Possibly that's true for retrofitting, but it should not be for new construction. Patricia says, consider the cost for the outages of the past 3 years, lost work and school time, lost sales, not to speak of the enormous cash cost of repairs. What do you think? Or have we gotten to the point where burying power lines might be a better idea?
There's sort of a false premise out there that burying power lines solves the problem, but it is extremely expensive, and underground power lines themselves fail. There were several underground residential developments that did not have power in any one of the states in New England that got hit by this, Massachusetts, Connecticut, or New Hampshire. And it's because all of the rest of the system is overhead. So you're going to have damage on the system. Underground might protect an individual home loss, but it won't protect the grid in its entirely. And underground has its own problems. Underground facilities do not last forever. They do fail, and when they do fail, they're very difficult to repair.
Because you got to dig under there to get them.
Yes, and you have to even locating the fault is difficult. And if you can imagine the middle of winter with frozen ground, how you'd go about fixing that, and how long people might be while you try to do that.
Well, so lessons learned, Gary. You know, I know this last Halloween storm was kind of freaky, heavy tree limbs because the leaves were still on the trees. Very strange to see fall colors peeping through the snow. But what could you apply from this latest Halloween storm to future storms that we all know are out there?
I think all of these last 4 events what they've said is there's a tremendous thirst for information by communities and by people. So we have radically expanded our network of people who work on communications and networking and outreach during a storm, in addition to all the work we do to actually repair. So that's certainly each time, I think the demands of society keep growing, and so we try to respond to those increasing demands. But I think the bigger lesson, I don't know if it's a lesson, it's an observation, is that these are regional events. As I said earlier, if they were just single events in a single state, they're much easier to deal with because you can get resources. But when utilities in a region have to board a 10 times increase in their workforce as soon as possible, there just simply aren't enough resources in New England to handle a regional event. So you have to reach long distances to get help, and it takes time for those that help to come.
Did sound like PSNH got lots of help, though, from Canada and Midwestern states and so forth.
Oh, the process works. We are very happy with the response that we got, but it does take a couple of days to get here. And in those first couple of days, when you're assessing the damage, when you're trying to get roads open, and you're trying to reestablish schools and emergency centers and that sort of thing, it's obviously very hectic and very busy. But the process works, and then we always ramp up. We had a fourfold increase in our own workforce in Connecticut, more than a tenfold increase in our workforce. And I think that's what the public has a hard time imagining, that the damage is so extensive, and it is a labor-intensive restoration, that getting the resources is probably the biggest challenge.
Well, and I know we've talked a lot about, you know, weather, extreme and heavy trees and so forth. Is there anything, Gary, that PSNH should be doing differently, might be doing differently from here on out, given your experience with this Halloween storm?
Well, anything different we do is going to cost more money, so that would have to be something we have to work out with the government and regulators, because if you want to spend money in anticipation of a storm, having a standing workforce, you can do some things like that. But if everybody in New England does that, that just raises the costs for everybody and puts you back at square one. You still need the resources that you need. One of the earlier speakers mentioned the idea of individual preparedness. I think that is the key. If we are going to have more of these large regional events, I think individual preparedness is really going to be a good solution, a better solution, because we know how to restore the system, and we'll always be able to do that. But how long can people wait, and how do they deal with life in the meantime?
Well, Gary, thanks a lot for joining us.
I thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Gary Long again, President and CEO of PSNH. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at emergency preparedness, given all the crazy weather that we've had over the last decade. How do you see our emergency preparedness improving or getting worse over the years? What are the biggest gaps that you see in our system of readiness and response to major weather events? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And before we go to the phones, Russ Webster, Chris Pope, I did want to talk to you about the electricity situation as well, the electric reliability question. What do you think, Russ? Is a federal review necessary, or are the senators Ayotte and Shaheen and Governor Lynch just trying to show constituents that they feel their pain?
Well, I think reviews are good in general. I put my focus with working with people like Chris Pope and acknowledge the fact that 51% of the people nationwide have experienced power outages of 3 days or more, and it's clearly an emphasis area for preparedness where combining state and federal resources and local resources is necessary to get individuals, communities, and other organizations better prepared. And FEMA has a number of programs that are specific to business preparedness, for example, that is related to power outages. We have a whole line of programs that are related to continuity of operations planning, specific to businesses, small and large, as well as universities and colleges. So I think from my perspective, a review is always good. However, our focus, and Chris and my focus, is focusing on how do we get the individuals, schools, businesses, and organizations better prepared for what is, frankly, a New England reality.
It is a New England reality, and I hear you on individual responsibility, Russ, but I wonder, is that getting utilities off the hook? I mean, they need to keep up the maintenance, they need to make sure they have enough staff, and so forth.
I think the private sector plays an incredible pivotal role in power maintenance and restoration. And again, I think reviews are an excellent idea.
What do you think, Chris, real quick?
I agree. I think I'd take it maybe even one step further. I think we really need to pull this whole thing apart. We need to fully, as the governor has suggested, look at, how did the utilities prepare themselves? What kind of data were they looking at? What kind of decisions did they make in advance of the storm? We'll leave that to the Public Utilities Commission here in New Hampshire to do. That's their area of expertise. But I would go on to say that we also have an obligation to pull apart our response and readiness. And we've got to be very critical of ourselves as, you know, in terms of our responsibility for the entire team effort. The other thing is, if it's branches and trees that are breaking lines, then we got to figure out a better way, a cost-effective, economically viable way of not having trees break power lines as much as they are.
Tree trimming? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, because power outages, well, whatever it takes, you know, I mean, that seems imminently logical to me, and I realize it's an investment, it's a time. You know, grandma and grandpa got married under the beautiful chestnut tree. It's in our front yard. We don't want the branches cut off. Well, you know what? Those branches hit the lines that serve 400 people downstream from your house. And in addition to that, some of the people that live there have some very significant functional needs, challenges, medical equipment that relies on electricity. So there's some in businesses that if they're down, they're bringing our communities down. We need our small businesses up and operational. So I think we need to take a much more aggressive look at that, not to spend money willy-nilly or put utilities in harm's way economically, but the bottom line is we all pay for the power, and there may be a cost to this, but the PUC's got to kind of work through that.
I think
we do have to fix some of this stuff.
You know, and
sure.
Again, as you look at the trees, this was a big discussion, Chris, after the ice storm of 08. There was a lot of talk about tree trimming and lines going down because of branches weighted with ice. So why are we still talking about this? That was 3 years ago.
Well, I'm kind of asking myself, how come all these branches haven't just broken? Why are there still branches that are there? It is, Laura, that's the reason. The serial nature of this, in both in terms of the events and the consequence, and the impact that it has on people's lives. And Russ talked about the $1 billion. That's the tip of the iceberg. You know, there's a lot of indirect costs and expenses to us and our families and our businesses. So it's beyond. We need to pull this whole thing apart and find a better way of mitigating, our situation here and preventing further damage.
And gentlemen, earlier I mentioned that the emergency alert system is going to undergo its first nationwide test at 2 this afternoon. Now, I was told earlier that this would last 3 minutes. It's 30 seconds, so I misspoke.
Correct.
There. So it'll be on all the radio and TV stations nationwide, just 30 seconds. So I want to let listeners know about that. Let's invite you to our conversation now, 1-800-892-6477. Mike is calling in from Lebanon. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. Thanks for hanging on.
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about the preparedness before the thing hit. And I'm a semi-retired journalist. And when I was a reporter up in northeastern New York, which is very rural, back in the early 90s, we had county offices that were doing things like compiling lists of hazmats that could be anything from propane tanks to the Clorox at a Walmart, so that the fire departments would know going in what would happen. And for a reporter, what it meant was when there was something like the ice storm of 98, you made one phone call, and there was someone there that could say, okay, this is what's happening, bing, 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 bing. And that also was true for the fire departments. It meant you had tanker task forces for big fires that could be instantly dispatched. When I came down here and we had the ice storm of 08, I said to my reporters, okay, call emergency. And they said, who? And they had to call each town hall. And this was the next day. I mean, it was the morning after the storm.
This
they
is a great
call
point,
each
Mike.
Each town hall to find out what had happened in their town.
And Mike, hold on, because I want to let Chris Pope respond to this, and then I've got someone else who's going to join us who does this work at the local level. So just hold on, Mike, and thanks a lot for the point. Go ahead, Chris.
I apologize, Laura. I'm not quite sure I understand his point. The construct in New Hampshire, there are states such as New York, which is a very large state, that has county emergency management.
The counties here aren't as involved.
There is
involved
no county emergency
as they are in
management
other
construct. There are 234 communities.
So should there be?
Report, but, well, I think it's a great debate. I will tell you right now, that is not where the system's broken. And I'd love to chat with Mike offline sometime to get a sense of exactly where he was going with that line of questioning. What he was talking about in terms of hazmat and who maintains hazardous materials database information, we do that. That's from the 1986 Superfund reauthorization amendment. So the state does maintain that data. Local communities maintain that data. So we do that. And again, I'm not quite sure where Mike was going with that.
Well, there's no
question.
One sort of central place to get that information for your area. You got to call, the 10 or 15 towns in your area.
Well, if you live in a community, your local fire department would have information about hazardous chemicals. The state fire marshal's office also has that information.
Well, and we've got a local firefighter with us now on the line from Derry. George Klauber is here. He's fire chief and director of emergency management in Derry. And George, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, first of all, just to answer our caller's question, is there information in sort of one central place where people can get it, or is it a little bit too scattered among our 230-some-odd towns?
Well, it's getting better, Laura. Really, starting at about the time of the ice storm, one of the things that the state had implemented and continues to grow is a web-based program that allows the local emergency managers, it's known as WebEOC, for us to log in, and we can get information. We can find out where shelters are open, if they're a pet-friendly shelter. We can find out, if we care to, which roads and which communities are shut down and whether it's a partial closure. So there is a better method for us to do some information sharing between the communities. But a lot of that, as the caller said, is true. It's really up to your local community to gather that information and then our responsibility to share with the state. And there are methods for us to do that.
How do you log in when the power's out?
Well, it's very interesting and I heard this during the ice storm, and it was a sad comment that the people were calling and saying that their local emergency operations center in their communities had lost power. And I asked that same question, how do you do that? And that's through preparation. And we've asked our residents and our citizens to be prepared. And I think we have to be prepared at the local level for those. So in Derry, we have an operating emergency operations center. It's on a battery backup automatically. But I would tell you that as good as all of these are, we had a problem in one of our storms in the last 2 years. Where the generator broke down, and we had a backup plan. We moved. We happened to be in the municipal center in Derry, but we moved out immediately, and were able to do that really without blinking an eye. People in the town wouldn't have realized that we moved all of our operations to the police department because that was part of our plan. And I continue to stress the word plan for residents and citizens, for communities, and at the state. I mean, we have to continue to not only write the plans, review the plans, and then operate the plans.
And Chief Klauber, I have a couple more questions for you. We have to take a short break, so sit tight, and when we come back, one or two more questions. Stay with us.
The Tupelo Public Radio Project brings nationally renowned musicians to a New England stage. I'm Kate McNally. Join me for the first of this live concert series featuring the talents of Katie Curtis.
If I make a mark in time, I can't say the mark is mine. I'm only the underline.
Catch Katie Curtis live on stage at the Tupelo Music Hall in White River Junction, Vermont. The fun starts at 8 on November 11th. Get your tickets at nhpr.org.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and from your local Culligan man committed to improving the quality of water in homes and businesses from the seacoast to the North Country for 75 years, online at getculligan.com. And Bernstein Schur in Manchester, providing practical legal solutions to a diverse group of public and private clients since 1915, online at bernsteinschur.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at New Hampshire's disaster preparedness, especially after that Halloween nor'easter. And as we approach winter, we all know more storms will be coming. We're talking about what we've learned from all these events of recent years and how communities are getting ready for the next emergency. Chris Pope is with us, Director of New Hampshire's Division of Homeland Security, and Russ Webster. He's with the FEMA Office of New England in Boston. Joining us now on the phone is George Klauber. He's Fire Chief and Director of Emergency Management for Derry. And Chief Klauber, a couple more questions for you. Just before the break, you were talking about the importance of having a plan and then a backup plan and then a backup plan to that. It is one thing to have a plan on paper, and I'm sure you've learned over the years another thing to do it, to put it into place.
And exercising the plans that we have, we have a model. We work closely with FEMA and the state. We've done that in Derry. A number of other communities have done that. We've done that regionally. But one of the things that I think is really important, and I think Director Pope talked about this maybe earlier on in the show, but after the ice storm, a group was put together to look at an after-action report with recommendations.
Is this ice storm 08 or 98? I'm just curious.
This is the 08,
okay.
Or at least the one that I'm aware of. And there probably have been other ones. I actually had the opportunity was invited to sit in on that committee as a local emergency manager and to hear our side and what they could do better. And many of those have been instituted. Are we perfect? Far from that. But we're getting better with each time. And I think it's important, and we will this time, and I've heard the director and I've heard Russ talk about this today, of reevaluating, what went well, what we can do better. We do it locally. I think they do it at the state level. And then it's a matter of implementing those and redoing your plan and not taking that plan when you have an emergency, Laura, and dust it off and come down and blow it off. I mean, it's something that it's got to be a regular part of your emergency operations is to pull the plan down and look at it and see if it's realistic.
Right. We were talking earlier about, keeping up to date with all this. You piqued my curiosity. You said we looked at what worked well and what we could do better. What could we do better as a state or as a local community, in your opinion, Chief Klauber?
Well, I mean, we talk today, we're talking about a lot about the power outages and all that. And certainly there's going to be a lot of discussion as from tree trimming to utilities, but I think one of the things that we need to continue to do a better job at is having coordination amongst all of the entities. I saw that happen a lot better this time. I actually had a liaison directly with the PSNH that we were able to contact and help to prioritize them. That wasn't occurring a few years ago. We need to enhance those relationships, and I think the most important thing that we can do, and we found this after each of the storms, and I've looked at that in the last couple of days, is communications with both up and down the ladder. We've got to find better ways to communicate with the public prior to the storm, preparing them, and then during the storm. And we continue to try to find some unique and different ways to do that. They're going to be effective. And I think until we get that part of it down, Laura, we've not really succeeded in our emergency planning.
All right. Well, Chief Klauber, we'll probably be calling you again after the next emergency. Thanks a lot for your time this hour.
Well, thank you.
That's George Klauber, again, Fire Chief and Director of Emergency Management in Derry. Real quick to you, Russ Webster, your thoughts on that communication. I mean, there are lots of agencies and offices and bureaucracies involved, from you at the federal level, Chris Pope at the state level, George Klauber at the local level. What do you think?
Well, Laura, just a quick observation. Really, the one thing that I would pin a rose on as something we all can improve on is traditionally we've really struggled with conducting these type of reviews with both the public and the private sector, and recognizing that in power, especially in transportation, the private sector represents about 85 to 90% of both the problem and the solution. And I think through greater collaboration in the planning phase and perhaps the review phase is going to reveal some really interesting partnerships and unique and innovative solutions. I think one of the things that I've seen happen consistently throughout New England is that during times of disaster, those individuals and entities and businesses that might have been competitors are often the biggest and best collaborators in an emergency. And I think we need to transition that type of collaboration from the response phase into the planning phase.
Well, and Chief Klauber talked about communications, and joining us now with more on that is Alicia McDevitt. She's news director for WMUR. She's been there for 16 years. And Alicia, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, and this is when everybody tunes into the TV station to watch those storms coming toward us. When there's a weather emergency, Alicia, how do you, as news people, strike the right balance between telling folks, okay, get prepared, but not going overboard? You don't want people to panic.
That's right. And that's a conversation that we have all the time in the newsroom, how to temper that. And we look at it as beforehand, we need to really give people the right amount of information so that they can be prepared. And we're always in contact with people like Chris Pope and other local agencies to find out where they're at as far as alerting people and what they think their public safety message is going to be. And we try to temper it that way. And then as the storm goes on, we watch it too to see what is happening so that we can give people the most current and updated information.
And I bet you have a big generator there at WMUR.
We sure do.
With the October storm, Alicia, some have noted that predictions were off. The snow was much worse than expected. What do you make of that discrepancy?
Well, what happened with this storm is we didn't get the rain that we thought we were going to get, and so it was off. And there was nothing in history to compare this to. In 140 years of record keeping, we had only gotten 3 inches of snow in Concord, and so we crushed that. That will happen when you don't have history to look back onto.
Do you think the public's expectations, Alicia, are too high that you and your weather folks will get it absolutely right?
I don't. I think it's interesting the way that it's evolved and the way that people consume their news and their weather now, that it's everywhere. There are apps on phones and there are alerts and there's Twitter. And so everyone's got a way to get the weather and people are really interested in it. It's one thing that impacts everybody. And so we do our best to get it right. And our team of meteorologists look at as many models as they can, and they use history, and they study it that way. But I think now there's a difference of the way that people consume it and all of the numbers of ways that they can get it. And people can form their own opinions now, too, which makes it a little difficult for us.
Right. Well, and Alicia, you've been there for 16 years. I've been here for 16 mm-hmm. years. What do you think we as news people have learned about reporting on emergency preparation, emergency response, over the past decade, especially given that over that time, Alicia, we've seen a fair number of weather emergencies?
We sure have. If we go back to October of 2005, when there was that horrible flooding in Alstead, that was really the first big storm, I think, other than the ice storm in the late 90s, that we covered here. And that was the first storm that we covered differently because people all of a sudden had cell phones with cameras in them. And it was very different. It was very difficult for us to cover news that day and what was happening with that flooding because our crews physically couldn't get to the areas they were trying to go to.
Right.
And what happened is people started sending us pictures and calling the newsroom and saying, I'm standing right here watching this now. And that started, for us in New Hampshire anyway, the user-generated content and how people are becoming citizen journalists, really, and helping us to get those messages out. Because when there are major natural disasters like that, it's hard for our crews even to get places, and it might take us a little longer than normal.
All right. Well, Alicia, it's been good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Alicia McDevitt, news director for WMUR TV. Chris Pope, your quick thoughts on the role the news media plays in all this. I mean, we don't always get it right either.
No, it's huge. They have obviously a responsibility to find the truth and report to the public things that they see, and that's their most important mission. For us, they have a second mission, and that is to be the public voice and to get emergency messages out. And in this day, and Alicia mentioned social media, that is really revolutionizing everything. And it's also revolutionizing emergency management and Homeland Security.
Because, even if the power goes out and
well,
you can't.
We had 12 public hearings after the 2008 ice storm. I attended most of them. And a woman, I think it was in Exeter, testified. And she said, you know what, Director Pope, you all did a great job communicating to all of the citizens in the state that had power. And you did a lousy job communicating.
Exactly.
The people it didn't. And she was right. She said, I said, ma'am, you are absolutely right. And we are still trying to work through that. People like George Clobber, you know how they communicate during power outages? They put situation reports on pizza boxes because they know everybody's ordering out for pizza when the power is out. And we're getting hugely positive feedback from people because we're taking unique ways or using unique ways to do it. We also need to do it with social media. The power may be out, but the cell phone, if you can plug it into your cigarette lighter in your car, has power, and Channel 9 is really doing a great job communicating that way. We've got to get that into the emergency management world so we can communicate as well.
Quick thoughts from you, Russ, and then back to our callers.
Yeah, I thought on it. I've got to be careful. I'm married to a journalist for 30 years now, so I always get this question. It's kind of interesting. It's a partnership, especially in the social media aspect, as like your earlier speaker, Alicia. You know, not only are the citizens reporters themselves, but they're also the first responders. And I saw that in the recent Irene response where in the morning I was talking to a group of people who were concerned about social media and flash mobs, the latest threat to college campuses and other areas about how social media is used for not necessarily good purposes to bring people together in places that there may not be authorized. In the same day, I was working with a group of citizens, and I saw people ages 8 to 80 that had been brought together dynamically through Twitter, and they were helping muck out a barn and a home, and there were so many people that had come from six surrounding states that they had to put these volunteers in shift work because the response was so overwhelming. So I agree with Chris. We need to partner with the media, and we also need to partner with the public to start taking advantage of these new technologies.
Let's take one more call. This is Sherry waiting in Concord. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. I just wanted to point out, actually this comes great on the heels of what these guys just said, that the Internet has become an essential part of our infrastructure. Many of us, our television is dependent on the same cable as our computer access or Internet access. We don't all have smartphones. And when sometimes, like this last storm, my power didn't go out, but my cable went out. And it's still not working.
Wow.
And when I call Comcast, they don't know what to do about it. They tell me to refresh my router and everything, and I do that, and it doesn't work. It's been over a week, and their lines are still constantly busy, and they still say we're working on all of this from all over the state. You know, you can't use the social media or WMUR when your cable goes out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I wonder if anyone has been addressing the fact that high-speed Internet really has become a public utility that people depend on.
You know, Sherry, this is a great point. Yeah, thank you. In the interest of time, I'm going to let you go. Chris Pope, it's an important point, and I had the same situation myself.
Well, it is, and you know, we're evolving. 20 years ago, very few people had cell phones, and now almost everybody has cell phones. 2 years ago, almost nobody had a smartphone, and now I don't know what percentage have smartphones. So the whole thing is evolving almost more quickly than public safety, public health, and private sector forces working in emergency management can keep up with how to do the communication. But Sherry, you're absolutely right. I mean, in terms of your particular issue, I certainly hope your utility can help you out with that. But I think the bigger picture of what you're talking about is we know that we cannot rely rely 100% on one means of messaging. And that's why at 2 o'clock this afternoon, there's going to be a national test of EAS, which means if, you know, along with a smartphone that someday I hope you have, I also hope you have a battery-operated radio. Because the bottom line is that we do have the ability to communicate with citizens over radio using the emergency alert system. And having a battery-operated radio or one you can plug into your car is another means of communicating.
I have a real basic question. I'm not sure if you can answer it, Chris. When the Public Utilities Commission looks at the power grid, cable companies aren't part of that, even though Sherry says, look, they should be treated like a public utility since the public depends on them so
much. Well, from a technical business PUC perspective, I mean, the PUC will have to deal with that. In terms of how we approach emergency management and disaster response, they're very much a critical part of the team. And I will tell you that along with the four CEOs of the biggest utilities, electric utilities in New Hampshire, we had non-electric utilities present in the Situation Room with the governor during the disaster, communicating and saying, you know, sharing information.
During the Halloween storm.
Yeah, absolutely. And which is the way it should be. I mean, I think one of the lessons we're going to learn out of this is we need to start that communication before the storm arrives. We all do our storm preparedness. Now, I think one of the outcomes will be is that there will be a recommendation that we do that before the arrival of a storm. But the bottom line is they absolutely should be part of that communication loop. It's not just the electric utilities. We rely on the others as well.
Sherry, thanks. It's a great point. And Russ, to you too. Big picture, how do we approach emergency response, emergency preparedness differently after this latest storm?
Well, I think picking up on the theme that Chris is talking about, clearly technology is an important piece of it. And there are entire organizations that have a focus right now and have free programs like SafeAmerica.org has an entire program for the public and businesses that is focused on how to communicate more effectively using social media during disasters. For example, they have a text first, talk later program that acknowledges and recognizes that based on how cellular works, texting is generally more effective and uses as little as 1/800th of the bandwidth that a regular telephone call would be. Part of our job here in Boston is to find the exemplar organizations in emergency management, such as the Boston Police Department and other organizations that have figured out how to better use social media.
All right. Well, Russ, I got to let you go.